Piki mai kake mai and welcome. From Radio New Zealand National, here's Our Changing World.
The rest of the show is devoted to a special feature from a recent conference encouraging us all to consider our responses to living in a world with a changing climate. Alison Balance was there for Our Changing World.
The New Zealand Climate Change Research Institute at Victoria University in Wellington recently organised a conference called Climate Futures – Pathways for Society. The conference took as its premise that the issues that future climate change raise for society go far beyond the underlying physical sciences and lead to basic questions about how society should respond to likely climate change futures, both individually and collectively. Our Changing World recorded the evening cafe session, at which four speakers were invited to challenge the audience to think about how society could take the lead in responding to climate change. The first speaker was Sir Lloyd Gehring, one of New Zealand's leading theologians and thinkers.
I suspect I am the oldest person in the room. I was born during the First World War. You can work that out for yourself. Any older, let me know. And because of that, my lifetime compassed most of the 20th century. And during the 20th century, I have witnessed tremendous changes taking place, both nationally and internationally. Humankind, at the beginning of the 20th century, particularly in the advanced countries, looked into the future with tremendous hope and expectation. Because of the developing technologies and science, it was felt that the sky was the limit. Here we were able to take over this earth and make something of it. During the century, that original enthusiasm and confidence slowly waned, and I witnessed that going on. Because only since the perhaps 1970s did we slowly begin to realise that what we were doing to the earth was destroying the very basis of our life. During this time, I saw tremendous changes taking place religiously as a result of this. At the beginning of the century, the churches were full. The Christian tradition was full of confidence that it had a slogan, the Christianization of the world in our generation. That was it, in our generation. Missionaries were going to every non-Christian country of the world. Gradually during the 20th century, I saw the whole missionary process decline and wither and stop altogether, while the churches, full at the beginning of the century, were beginning to empty. And today, they are closing up at a rather rapid rate. There has been a tremendous change take place during the 20th century. At the beginning of the 20th century, the word racism did not exist for the simple reason we were all racists. It was obvious to everyone that our own race was superior to all the other races. Only slowly did we come to appreciate that people who differed from us in race, in colour, and religion, and culture were perhaps just as good as us. And so a great change took place globally in the human race. Whereas once, indeed, here in New Zealand, we were proud to be British. We were proud to belong to the British Empire on which the sun never set. And then the British Empire collapsed. And then there were not only the Great War in which I was born, but a Second World War, and it made us realize that we, sophisticated human beings, had yet to learn how to live together. Indeed, those two world wars shattered our confidence in the human condition. And we know how frail and ignorant we are compared with the confidence we had at the beginning of the century. But on the other hand, there were some wonderful things to celebrate during the 20th century. We became aware of racism, and we all reject it. We became aware of human rights for all human beings and began to promote it nationally and internationally. We became aware that women were just as important as men, and the feminist movement had a great success. We're still a bit stuck with homosexuals, but we are winning the day on the sexual front. In 1999, as we came to the end of the century, I was in Oxford at a bit of a loose end. My late wife, who was then doing a PhD, was busy in the library, and she said, "You better write a book." So I began to do some research on the future of the world. And the next year, I published a book entitled The World to Come. Now, that phrase, as you probably know, comes out of the Christian tradition and refers to heaven. But I wasn't referring to heaven. There is no such place. I was referring to the 21st century, the world to come. And as I began to study what was happening and projecting those trends into the future, I might say I became more and more depressed. For example, during the 20th century, the human population quadrupled. Can you imagine that? Now, up until 1900, anything that humans did by way of interfering with nature had no substantial effect. Nature was still much more powerful and could overcome all that we rather powerless humans were able to do. But quadruple the human race, and it's a different story altogether. We are now able to destroy the productivity of the earth. Not only are there four more times the mouths to feed, but we have to find the way to produce that food. And so we began to tear down the forests. And in so beginning, of course, the problem with carbon dioxide and global warming. Now, that was only the beginning of the various things that I began to study. And so I set out the future of the world to come in 10 scenarios. Not all of them, by the way, were interdependent. Two or three or more of these scenarios could eventuate at the same time. 9 of these scenarios were absolutely disastrous. Well, even I felt I had to do a bit better than that. So I did produce a 10th scenario in which we muddled our way through, but it is going to be exceedingly difficult. And that is why a conference like this is so important. I reached my 8 minutes.
The second speaker at this Climate Futures conference session was Robert Gifford, an environmental and social psychologist at the University of Victoria in Canada, and co-author of the American Psychological Association's Task Force report on climate change.
It almost seems like I should be doing stand-up. So, I will. I'm going to give. I've never done this before. And I'm stealing this line from a very, very crude comedian that you could never repeat his jokes, even in this circumstance. But I'm not going to tell you his name. My daughter turned me on to him. But British Columbia, as far as I know, was the first or one of the first jurisdictions to impose a carbon tax. It has a 2% carbon tax. And you could say that a carbon tax or carbon trading scheme is a double-edged sword, because it has advantages and disadvantages. Well, this guy that I'm stealing this line from started riffing on the idea of a double-edged sword, and he said, well, marriage is a double-edged sword. Going to university is a double-edged sword. Traveling is a double-edged sword. Wait a minute. Everything's a double-edged sword. Even a single-edged sword is a double-edged sword. That's as much as I'll tell you about this guy. So anyway, I'm an environmental psychologist. You might say, what does psychology have to do with it? I guess my mantra in a single line is that each of us, each of the 6.5 to 7 billion people, are what's really driving the trouble or the progress, ultimately. You can make a policy. You can pass a law, think of smoking or seatbelt laws. Not everybody necessarily follows it just because a policy is made or a law is made. We actually consciously or unconsciously make a choice every day in terms of carbon usage. So this, for the environmental psychologist, says the action, although not entirely so, is very much at the individual level, which is the level of analysis that psychologists work on. So that's the level I work on. What is it that drives you and me to make the right choices or the wrong choices every day? Just to some extent, it's policies. To some extent, it's what looks good to other people. I'm told that the reason the Prius is such a successful, there are Priuses in New Zealand, I guess. The reason that they're successful, whereas the Honda version is not successful, is because a Prius has a distinctive profile, and the Honda just put its electric engine in a regular looking thing. So then, in other words, the reason people buy Priuses is to show the world that they're virtuous. If you buy a Honda, you don't look any different than any other Honda driver. So social factors are important. What other factors are important? Well, lots of things. How we think, what we believe, what other people who are important to us are doing, etc. So environmental psychologists are very concerned about this level of interpersonal, personal kinds of factors that go into it. Now, my own special interest arose out of journalists calling me up and saying, we have a problem here. We heard a lot today in the forum about skeptics and deniers, and they certainly exist, and they, I could tell you stories. I'll try to keep to my 8 minutes, but they certainly exist. But really, in most of the world, somewhere around 80% of people are quite convinced that climate change is happening and that there's a strong anthropogenic aspect to it. But they're still not doing everything that they do. So the journalists would say, how come if 80% of people think that there's a problem, that not enough people are doing anything and the carbon emission rates are going up way past 350 into the 380 range and not showing much in the way of signs of stopping? So, Mr. Psychologist, they would say, give me a soundbite as to why that's happening. I started looking at this about 6 or 7 years ago, and I've gradually developed a kind of soundbite answer to that question. And I'll quickly go through them. One is that we have an ancient brain. Human brain hasn't, according to the evolutionary people I know, really evolved much for about 30,000 years ago. 30,000 years ago, we were wandering around in Africa in small bands, and all we cared about was the here and now. We didn't care about 5 years from now, or 2050, or even what was going on in the next band 2 kilometers away, as long as they weren't stealing our resources. So the tendency is here and now. Climate change is not a here and now problem. Second, we have some very, very powerful ideologies out there, which we've heard about today in the forum, that are what I call umbrella ideologies. They cover a lot of territory, but part of the territory they cover is this can't be a problem, or we can't do much about it. Third, it's a very boring concept, but we all have investments in the current system. Part of it is just our behavioral habits. Breaking habits is hard. Everybody who's tried to have a diet knows it's not easy. Tried to change their life is not easy. Financial investments or just investments in a behavior pattern. It's not flattering us to say, but we're very, very influenced by what other people do. So if we're in a certain social circle, we are very influenced by those other people, and a lot of those other people are not doing the right thing in terms of carbon. Sometimes it's hard to break out of this circle that we're in. I heard that the mayor rides her bike to work. She's not your typical mayor, I can tell you that. But most people who should be serving as role models are not doing the right thing. Then, sad as it is, climate change is not the only thing that we're concerned about. All of us are concerned about our health. All of us are concerned about improving ourselves. I usually ask people, if you were to keep at your same, especially the younger people, if you're under 35, answer me this. Are you willing to keep your current income or salary and housing for the rest of your life? I doubt it. We all have goals and aspirations to somehow better ourselves somehow. We hope it's in a green way, but we want to get better. Well, most ways of getting better are not carbon friendly, sadly enough. So then not in this room, but as we know, there's a huge amount of discredence in the world. That is anti-intellectualism in the States. I have to tell you this one story. Right after I'm one of the authors of the American Psychological Association's Task Force report on climate change. The day after it came out, Glenn Beck, who is the star of the Fox News, came on and he said, guess what? The APA came out with a report about climate change. And if you can believe this, he held up a copy of 1984 and he said, the shrinks are trying to manipulate us again. And that was the end of the discussion. There was no further discussion about it. So it's kind of anti-intellectualism is rampant, and Mr. Beck is a very popular person in, I hope not outside the U.S., but the final problem that most of us have is that what we're doing for most of us, including me, is not enough. So, I oversimplify, but I say, well, I recycle. Isn't that good enough? And no, recycling, although it's a good thing to do, is not enough. We all have to do more. I have a graduate student who comes in every week for her meeting and says, did you drive to work again? She's a cheeky little thing. She's not afraid of me. And so it's always that. So I have ridden to work 5,000 times, so I'm pretty good. But when I did that, I lived fairly close to campus. So now I live farther away. I drive partway and walk the rest of the way. It's my kind of compromise at my advanced age. But she's always saying, I rode my bike today. What did you do? And it's true. So I feel somewhat guilty about speaking even, because I'm certainly not much better than anybody else. We all need to do more, and that's probably my final word. What else could you do? Thank you.
The third speaker was Bronwyn Haywood, a senior lecturer in political science at the University of Canterbury, specialising in children's issues, democracy and citizenship and environmental change.
Tēnā kōrua, Ian, Morgan, ngā mihi, mahana, kia koutou. It's with very warm greetings that I say it's lovely to be home after 3 years in the UK, even if coming home meant flying the last leg from Auckland to Christchurch on the 22nd as the quake struck. So, like everyone from Christchurch, my talk tonight is set against the background of the tragedy that's unfolding at home. In the grief and the struggle, and it's fascinating to me at a personal level and very humbling as somebody who works in resilience, to experience being at the periphery in a crisis. So, as we struggle with the ongoing personal and collective loss, dislocation and turmoil which was unleashed by the energy of Ruamoku, the god of earthquakes, there are some opportunities to rethink basic principles about what really matters amid the turmoil of the earth cracking and in the rubble of stone buildings, an English delusion we probably never should have built, but we loved anyway, in the loss of our homes and our families and the tension that's in our community. There are also new insights that grief brings into our past and our future. Working as I do around questions of the impact of dangerous environmental change on our democracies, our politics, and our citizens, it is humbling to observe the power vacuums, the spiritual turmoil, the physical, the economic, the cultural, and the social disruption that happens in the wake of a major disastrous event. It's a truism to say that hazards are socially constructed. They're not a hazard unless a person's in the way. But how we respond to that hazard, whether it's a sudden and cataclysmic event like an earthquake or a tsunami or, for Japan, both and radiation, or whether it's the series of slow, imperceptible daily changes that shift a problematic situation like a change in climate into a major disaster, however we experience our disaster, how we respond is affected by what's gone before, our relationships, our experiences, our cultural and spiritual depth. We know a lot from other communities that have faced dangerous change. We know that they go through collective experiences, much like grief. We've gone through and experienced the surge that they call the surge of mutuality or the goodwill. Then we're currently experiencing, really, the beginning of the period of intense anger and tension and blame. Then there's usually, they tell us, a new phase of vision. And then, usually, but I'd like to argue tonight, hopefully not inevitably, a reassertion of the old power, usually reinforcing and exacerbating the existing inequalities. But let's imagine and consider the times in which we can act to make something different, to change the trajectory so that we're not just resilient, reinforcing our existing patterns and ways of behaving, but actually transforming and changing. What are some of the moments in which we can achieve transformation? How could we take another path when faced with a disaster? Why is it that we're more likely to carry on with business as usual, even when we're faced or even we're in the middle of a disaster? I was thinking about, when Robin talked about the ancient brain, about Clive Hamilton and Anthony Giddens, both talking about, again, that kind of disposition that we've got, that we have these immediate, visceral, strong reactions to danger, but we don't really deal effectively with the long-term reasoning and the long-term issue. What makes it worse is that we tend to, and you can see it at home at the moment, react to dangerous or overwhelming situations with the kind of unhelpful behaviours of denial or distraction, blaming others or enforced optimism. There is really an enormous burden of this contract stay in Christchurch, for instance, all of which reinforce a natural tendency to think in the short term or to avoid the difficult situation. But while we know that taking another path is unlikely, it's not impossible. And I say this very carefully. When I say that I'm alarmed, really, at the move that we're having intellectually between the joining of individualistic psychology and economics and the emphasis now on behaviour change. Because what I would like to argue is that While I have learnt and we learn collectively a great deal from psychology, also other ways of seeing the world and thinking about how we act politically as citizens and collectively also is useful. And there are many times in history politically where people, individuals and citizens have taken action against overwhelming odds. And when we act as a citizen, we act in a different way. And I'd like to think for a minute about what some of those preconditions are that make us act differently. When do we act with courage? When do we act with hope as determination, or faith as an unrealized possibility, as Hannah Arendt would say, or trust in others? And to do that, I turn for a moment to the earthquake and to the university students of Sam Johnson and six others. Six students organized 1,000 students, and then within 6 days, they'd organized communication with 24,000 people. Now, it wasn't just Facebook and Twitter that did that. There are a whole lot of things that enabled them to do that, particularly the ability to build on existing organizations and networks. But actually, I would suggest that the trajectory which will change and define our future is the energy of our youth. We've heard a lot about the barriers to change, and it's fascinating to me that we're having the same debate that we had through the limits of growth in the 70s. And when you go back and read the first report of the limits of growth, how could they have said in the first chapter that people don't take action and don't think in the long term, writing as they were right in the middle of the biggest civil revolutions that we had seen for generations? And I would say we're doing the same again. We're saying, how do people not take action when all around the world, young people are on the streets and changing the face of our politics and our communities? And we, again, as an environmental movement, are missing the point. They're not talking about climate change. They're talking about the grim reality that they're facing, that actually the drivers of which the symptoms are climate change. And despite their very grim futures, despite the lack of employment opportunities, the sheer numbers, if you look at the numbers, for instance, for the Middle East, UNICEF produced an economics report last week that says for the average 13-year-old in Libya at the moment, for them to be employed when they're 23, we have to create 45 million jobs every year for the next 10 years. So in those situations, we've been so busy marketing to this generation, so busy defining them as Generation X and Y, or the millennials, that we've actually forgotten to stop and think, as the think tank Demos has said recently, and Zygmunt Bauman, to consider actually what the future looks like for this generation of 1.6 billion teenagers. It's very different from their parents and their grandparents. Not just in the huge surge of numbers internationally and the lack of employment, but actually, because the baby boom generation has of the 40s and 60s has actually dominated politics, and the conservative writer David Willetts describes it as the pinch, stealing from our children. But the behaviours that we really need to change and think about are the behaviours of the baby boomers. This is the generation who's benefited from the low-cost home loans, from the free state education, from the years of low inflation, from the ability to travel and the networks that built up, from the political clout at the ballot box, from the shifts of public to private funding, from pension investments that don't go where the community and education needs it. We have failed to invest in the future assets and infrastructure of the world of our children. So when you ask me what behaviours should we change, I would say, please, as an older generation who has the ability to think backwards and look forwards, we need to think about our investment, our power, our morality. We need to find commitment devices that shift the burden from our future to us. Thank you.
The final speaker for this Climate Futures Conference session, Gareth Renadon, runs the Hot Topic blog, covering climate change science, policy and politics from a New Zealand perspective. He's also a writer, photographer and truffle grower.
Now, these are my notes, and I'm just sort of randomly arranging them here. I sort of slightly modified. I had a sort of carefully structured 8-minute talk, which I thought I might give, but as a consequence of the proceedings today, it's become apparent that a few of you might want to know rather more about what I do and less about what I think you should do. So I'm going to talk a little about being a blogger. I'm not sure I like being introduced as a blogger. What I am is a writer, and I'm a writer who likes to have the vanity of his own medium. So Hot Topic was first a book and then a blog, but I'm not sure whether it was a book first or a blog first. Did I do the book because I wanted a blog, or did I do a blog and then turn it into a book? In fact, it was both. I wanted to write a book about climate change because I thought it was an important issue for my kids. And as I was writing the book, as I was digging into this information, I realized I was dealing with a really fast-moving field. In the introduction or the first chapter of Hot Topic, which will be available in all good bookshops as soon as my distributors can pull their fingers out, I said that, you know, I thought it might be possible that the Arctic sea ice would be disappear in summer in my lifetime. And I thought I was being really, really radical in daring to put that in print. I was writing that at the beginning of 2007. And in the middle of 2007, September 2007, the reduction in the Arctic sea ice, there was something like a 25% reduction in the sea ice minimum. And that's when I realized that I was dealing with something that was just immensely important and happening really, really quickly. And what the blog format enables me to do is to respond to that really, really quickly. I mean, the things that I really like writing are the things where I really rip into skeptics. Parodying Lord Monckton, for me, is a holiday. I have a lot of fun writing that stuff. Being rude about Ken Ring fills me with pleasure every time I do it. So what I'm trying to do with the blog is I'm trying to communicate the seriousness of the problem that we have, and I'm reflecting on something that Brian Fallow said earlier this afternoon, that the kind of de-skilling of the media, and Eric Conway commented that journalism schools teach people to be journalists, they don't teach them to be specialists. What I'm trying to provide on the blog is a kind of continuity of understanding of the issue. So to provide context, to provide the things that the press find it hard to give us now. And that you know, I can't think of more than a couple of science journalists who produce regular material in the New Zealand press. There are honourable exceptions, but they are very much the exception and not the rule. So I also wanted to create a place where people could discuss the issue in a congenial sort of atmosphere. And I quickly discovered that brought us a whole raft of sceptics onto the site. And just something I checked in the last couple of days, we have a commenter he's about the only one around at the moment who believes it's his duty to argue a neoliberal or libertarian line on the blog. And under every post, this character who poses as John Dee turns up and he makes his standard libertarian claims. Now, John Dee visits the blog twice as often as any other reader. I mean, we're talking an average of something like 9 times a day, every day, over the last month. Now, what he's doing, I think, is evangelizing his cause. And if you, one of the things that often you get accused of, if you're writing about climate change, if you're commenting on climate change, is that, you know, it's a green religion. I think you can turn that around, because the people who are maintaining a faith in the face of the facts and who are evangelizing their position are the skeptics. And when you look at the arguments that they present, they amount to effectively wibble. I mean, they are nonsense. There are a whole bunch of guys, they wrote a book called Slaying the Sky Dragon, which claims to prove that the greenhouse effect doesn't exist. And these guys are widely blogged about, distributed, they commenters, they appear all over the place. So the method that I apply to this is what I call relentless rationality. As all you can do is just say, these are the facts, it's a serious problem, get over it. So the debate is not a scientific debate, although there's plenty of stuff in the science that's interesting and that fascinates me and that it's worth discussing. It's not a debate about science, although there are aspects, as Fred suggested today, where we do need to look at the way that we do science and improve it. This is a debate. This is an argument about what we do. And as Eric said today, it's been a very carefully constructed case to delay action on climate change. And so in my own small way on Hot Topic, which is probably the least read of all the climate blogs on the planet, but is reasonably successful in New Zealand. I try to apply some small corrections to that. The one thing I think it's terribly important that when you look at stuff on the internet, you do have to remember that the internet is not the whole world. There is a big wide world out there, and there are people who are taking this problem seriously and are just getting on and doing it, and they don't write comments on blogs. So what is it? That's what I do. What do we need to do? And I'm trying to pick up on what I thought was the theme of the evening. And what I believe we need to do is we need to build a consensus around action. I think it's quite interesting, and it would make a very good study in international relations that we have to define the scale of the problem, we have to define the speed with which it's happening, we have to look at the nature of the solutions, and we have to do a risk analysis that suggests how quickly and how steeply we should take action. Most of this was actually apparent about 15 years ago, and we're only just now getting around to beginning to kind of internalize that. We had a position where we had a Kyoto Agreement 15 years ago, and we've gone backwards from that. And I find that immensely frustrating. So it's been slow going. And I just wanted to give one quote. And it's from a guy called Lonnie Thompson. Lonnie Thompson will be well known to any of the climate scientists in this room. Lonnie's he's reputed to have spent more time at 15,000 feet than any other human on the planet because he goes and drills ice cores in the sort of glacial ice caps, particularly in the tropics. And Lonnie wrote a piece a couple of months ago for not a climate change journal, but discussing the nature of the climate change problem. And what he said was that as a result of our inaction, we have three options: mitigation, adaptation, and suffering. And my position, what I want to try and do, is minimize the suffering. Thank you.
That was Gareth Renaudin. And before that, you heard from Bronwyn Hayward, Robert Gifford, and Lloyd Gearing.
That's all for now. For more, check us out on the web, radionz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. Ma te wa.